City replaced the Dutch Bradley, who was accused himself of his way of vote. He was subjected to court rules and was taxed back to the court here. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mr. Anderson. As this court is aware of the case of your presentment to you today, as a state of the time, there's a man who lied.
How is it in conflict on the issue of the Allende rule? How is it really in conflict?
It's in conflict in that our court feels, and I guess I would submit at this point, is not really conflict with the Supreme Court's decision in Shepard, but it's in conflict in that they ruled that you could not question the jurors at all regarding whether or not there was any prejudice or if they were in any way that are partially affected by the outside.
The rule to have it certified to this court pursuant to the Constitution is that it has to be in conflict with another district court of appeals on a point of law. And I don't see that in this case, do you?
Well, I believe that it is a point of law in regards to the state versus Thomas decision, but the impression of jurors as an impartiality, and the applicability of Rule 606B.
Where did State v. Thomas come from?
I have to go there. I don't believe it was from a different district.
Of course.
And wasn't that a... To me, this becomes a factual question, whether or not somebody is talking about went on with during deliberations or outside of that. So I suppose you ought to explain, first of all, the Allende rule and how it is not something that is just confined to the deliberations, because this didn't have anything to do with deliberations.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think, even starting back further, though, it would be the state's position that this court should reverse the Court of Appeals inquiry instead of back and affirm the trial court's decision, because the Court of Appeals did not apply the proper standard in reviewing the case, and that they never addressed the issue of whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in rendering its verdict, which denied the motion on the trial.
But that's not a conflict issue, is it?
That's correct, but okay. That's not the only reason that the court admitted the case on this court. Allow the alternate jurors' testimony in regards to any misconduct.
I'm wondering if that isn't really academic. I mean, a juror, what's meant by a juror? I think that it's possible to say that it can mean nothing but those who deliberated, since the whole 606 deals with protecting jury deliberation. The evidence we have here from the alternate can't be said to be precluded by the... It has to be seen as extraneous, doesn't it? He is, though he was chosen to be a juror in the event that one other juror wasn't able to serve, that scenario didn't come to be, and therefore this person is not a juror.
Right. I believe, though, the aspect of the public policy argument applying that to the case, or this particular case, only because we also have a situation, as public policy has been stated in numerous cases, having jurors harassed or chased down by the losing party in the lawsuit. The question is whether or not the issue occurred within the realm of deliberations or any other aspects of it that might be able to be used to get a motion for a trial. I think the alternate juror falls within it. They are sworn just as the other jurors are to be served, just as the other jurors are to hear the evidence. They are in a unique situation where they are solely with those other jurors during that period of time. I think by saying that he's outside of that, you may encourage them, losing parties in lawsuits, and tracking down the alternate juror, people saying, well, what they talk about what they talk about he says. And I think that the public policy arguments should indicate that basically the decision or rationale of what they should be examined at the end, and maybe overruled in saying that an alternate juror is not the juror for purposes of the academic. The only reason I'm saying that is that I think my reading is that this court's decision to take versus Shepherd, which allowed a juror to report to the court itself, actually to the state of Ohio, that he had contacted a psychiatrist outside of that evidence came directly from that juror also. So I think it's academic as to the applicability of the Alley-Rundy rule, whether it's an alternate or not, other than I think the policy should have this court rule that he still is a juror within that meaning, because I don't think it's really ultimately get to the issue that's presented with this court. It would be our position that although...
But you wouldn't need public policy. You would just be construing Rule 606 when it says juror, that an alternate having been sworn, I mean, you wouldn't need public policy, would you? And you would say that this suits the purpose of the rule.
Right.
That's right. Okay.
It would be the state's position that there was misconduct in this particular case. Misconduct was by the alternate juror. Any misconduct by the other jurors was tacit in nature, or it was non-feasible in nature, that they didn't report it to the trial court. It's interesting to note that the trial court, in its findings of fact, determined that the other jurors obviously did not consider that to be important enough to have reported to the jurors, to the judge, the actual statements made by the alternate juror. But it's also interesting to note that the alternate juror also did not report that to the judge, because if you really look at the conduct of this, a juror who was disgruntled, and that's part of the public policy of 606, to prevent disgruntled jurors from coming back and impeaching their own verdict. If you have a disgruntled juror who tried to influence the case improperly, failed to do that, and that the trial court then would not allow him to have the power to influence the juror by coming forward later on, and then try to impeach the verdict of the jury, which he in fact did not even sit and deliberate on. I think the issue, though, that's going to be presented to court is whether or not the questioning by the court or by the prosecutor in regards to the effect of the misconduct had on the deliberative process or on those jurors. And it would be the state's position that the questions that were asked of those jurors during the course of that hearing asked whether or not the improper conduct before the deliberative process, before they were instructed by the court, before they went in there and deliberated, did the misconduct that occurred then affect their ability to be fair and impartial when they walked into that jury? Can we say that it didn't?
How is the defendant able to establish prejudice, or how do you lack prejudice?
By being able to question those jurors, I mean, and also possibly by the nature of the misconduct. In this particular case, the misconduct was not in any way prejudicial to the defendant. In fact, it was all favorable to the defendant. It took a tortured logic, in my opinion, by the Court of Appeals to try to infer prejudice by the comments that were made by the alternate juror.
But you could have the reverse process happening. the other jurors think he's trying to stretch it, he's trying to influence the decision, they could possibly be leaning the other way because...
Well, that's what the Court of Appeals found, but to do that, you have to speculate, and I don't think you can speculate. And then specifically, I don't think the Court of Appeals can speculate that it's directly contrary to the factual findings of prior facts without getting to the abuse of discretion standard. And that prior fact, that judge referred those jurors and heard the testimony of the alternate jurors found that he was not present, and that those jurors were not in fact prejudiced, or that they were not impartial when they went back in to deliver this case.
You see this case really simply the abuse of discretion case, the court is not wrong.
In fact, yes, in regards to the jurors' conduct, yes. And there's no question I have to reserve the time to last as I have.
I guess I have one. You suggest that the argument put before us by the appellee in support of the Court of Appeals judgment is that the court couldn't determine that this was that the jurors weren't affected by the misconduct because the court improperly inquired about the of the jurors about the effect on their deliberations, and that 606 precludes that. And you say, well, you could ask them about whether it affected them pre-deliberations, whether it affected them.
Whether they went in there as impartial jurors, whether the conduct occurred prior to the deliberative process, did that affect
yeah.
the ability to be impartial? And that's basically what the question is. There were no questions that were really asked about the deliberative process itself. Did they just, was it affected by the misconduct?
You go, whether you go in there as an impartial juror or not, I guess I'm wondering how separable that is, your the effect on you before you start working in the jury room versus the eventuality of how it affects you in the jury room. I just wonder about that concept.
I think it's going to have to be judged upon me by the prior fact.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the Court of Appeals can supplant its judgment in regards to that, that the contrary to the prior fact has an abuse of discretion.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Byers.
Your Honor, may I ask a procedural question before I begin today? I searched the rules for answering this question, and also spoke with the representative of the clerk's office that I haven't yet found an answer. As the court knows, there are four issues raised as cross assignments here in this case. I intend to touch on those things briefly in my opening remarks. My question, Your Honor, is there a process by which I can reserve a portion of my time for rebuttal solely on the cross appeal?
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time, and I'll try to submit that, please. Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Fritz Byers. I represent Matthew Reiner. To obtain reversal of the Court of Appeals judgment in this case, the state seeks to have this court repudiate three settled rules of the law of Ohio. Each of those rules is well settled, soundly rooted in policy and in law. Utterly non-controversial, and none of them has caused the slightest problem in the administration of justice. Nonetheless, the state, to secure reversal, would have this court completely disrupt the doctrine of Ohio on those three crucial points. Two of them arise under eventual 606D. The third is one of the fundamental presumptions that governs appellate review in Ohio. First, the rule is well settled in Ohio that under no circumstance may a juror testify about the juror's subjective mental processes or about the effect of any event on his frame, that juror's frame of mind regarding deliberations or the verdict. The rule is utterly unequivocal. It is stated in concise and clear terms in the first sentence of Rule 606D. This this court resoundingly affirmed that rule in the Shahill decision in 1990, and in that opinion, this court said this is a settled rule of Ohio, citing a decision in the Long case from 1922. For at least 78 years, the law has been unequivocal on that point. But the state would have this court change the law.
Are both the alleged conflict case, Thomas, and this case compatible on that point?
As the Court of Appeals decision purporting to certify the conflict in this case based on Thomas says, there is a phrase in the middle of a paragraph in Thomas that when read liberally might suggest that court considered a witness's avowal, pardon me, a juror's avowal of non-prejudice as being part of its analysis of when a jury misconduct had affected the outcome in the case. There is certainly no direct conflict between the Thomas decision and the holding of the Court of Appeals in this case. And more fundamentally,
not just on the first point, but on all four points.
That's the way I see it. Furthermore, there is no conflict, as the state has alluded in its briefing, between this court's decision in State v. Shepherd and the first sentence of Rule 606B.
You can't have a conflict between a Court of Appeals decision and this court.
I agree with that, although the state did submit what it called a notice of additional authority regarding conflict, purporting to cite this court's unanimous opinion in Shepherd as being in conflict. But as I'm sure this court is aware, our reading of Shepherd shows that, in fact, this court used precisely the language of 606B. It permitted introduction of juror testimony on the issue of whether improper influence had occurred, but specifically steered far clear of evaluating or taking into account the juror's testimony about the effect on his deliberative process of that misconduct. That's what Rule 606B says. Justice Cook's questions on that point are exactly correct. The first sentence of 606B could not be clearer. Likewise settled in the state of Ohio is the related but logically separate point that a testimony in the form of an affidavit or direct testimony from the stand of an alternate juror who has been excused and who did not deliberate is not precluded either under the express language of Rule 606B or under the policies that animate that rule. So, with respect to juror misconduct on those two evidentiary points, the Court of Appeals was correct. To the extent there were rulings to the contrary of this trial court, those rulings were wrong. There is no conflict. This court need only confirm that its rule, the rule you promulgated under your power, Revidence Rule 606B, correctly, succinctly, and clearly states the rule of Ohio on the evidentiary consideration.
Mr. Bias, then assuming that the state of the law with regard to burden of proof, where we've established juror misconduct or it's been properly brought before the court in consideration of Rule 606 and it's extraneous, then you have the Smith v. Phillips Sixth Circuit rule that says burden is on the defendant to show prejudice therefrom.
Correct.
Now, if one does not, I mean, how's that under your analysis, how is that discerned? Is it that the court hears, you know, with this, in your brief, it sounds like, you know, there was this in front of him, that was, and I, trial judge, just put it all together and say, if I were a juror, that would have affected me. Is that how it's done by a trial court? If you say that the court doesn't ask the jurors, I guess they ask, did you hear it? You would say that's not precluded by 606.
Correct. And so
Shepherd,
about whether it occurred.
You think that's what Shepherd stands for. Yes, so, okay. And so how is it done, as I say? The trial court says, well, look, a juror heard this, that, and the other, and in this kind of climate, you know, which is what you argue here, and I intuitively figure that would not affect or would affect a juror, and that's the way it's done. And is it my discretion, I being the trial judge, is discretion a part of that? once I analyze that, then we review my analysis by abuse of discretion standard.
I'm just going to take a note because I think there are three questions
okay.
you've asked, and I want to make sure that I address each of them, Your Honor. I think Your Honor's summary of the deliberative or analytical process that the trial court must go through in evaluating
yes.
this is essentially correct, although not to quibble with your words, I think it's correct except for your use of the word intuitive. I think it's more than intuitive.
What standard would I be using?
I also want to address the question of whether I think it's an abuse of discretion standard.
No, what would I use if it weren't my... it's my knowledge.
It's your knowledge. This kind of process you're on, Your Honor,
experience?
Not only is unique, not only is not unique to this, it's in fact a very common process of judicial analysis at every level under the common law. The process is ultimately not, what we're saying, Your Honor, is it is not tied to a participant's subjective statement of his or her own frame of mind. The testimony about events is like any other direct testimony, subject to evaluation for credibility. Once the court determines what events occurred and whether they constitute misconduct, or in the language of Rule 606B, improper extraneous influences that have been brought to bear on the deliberative process. Then the court undertakes an objective process based on its familiarity with the nature of jury deliberations, human nature, and common evaluation of how an individual's thought process would work in deliberations. An objective determination to determine whether the misconduct that has been established prejudice the defendant and the defendant's right to trial by jury. There's a very common analog to exactly this kind of process, Your Honor, and that has to do with contract interpretation. Every day of the week, trial judges are obligated to interpret a contract, but they do so under the plural evidence rule, utterly innocent of a party's subjective statements about his or her own frame of mind.
But we do say bias that in State or Phillips
that
Smith v. Phillips says show bias.
Right.
And we're saying show the judge that a juror could reasonably be biased by what they heard.
That's
a little different. Maybe that's not a difference, but
I think there are two things that are clear. To try and address the core of your question, Your Honor. That 606B expressly precludes a juror's subjective statements about the influence on his or her frame of mind about deliberations. And second, that it is the obligation of the trial court, as well as appellate courts, to address the fundamental question of whether because of misconduct that has been proved through competent evidence, one can conclude defendant was deprived in this case of his constitutional right to a fair and impartial jury. I suggest this kind of analysis has been going on for hundreds of years since Lord Mansfield first identified both prongs of what remained the prevailing law in Ohio, no subjective testimony, and an inquiry into the effect of prejudice on the right to trial by jury. And I think, in fact, the Court of Appeals decision of this case is a model of exactly how to do both of those things. It abjured any subjective testimony from jurors, determined what misconduct had taken place, and in the concrete situation of this trial, evaluated what the effect of that misconduct would have been on the mind of a juror obligated under his or her oath to deliberate fairly in this case.
But when now you're on to the next issue, which is that the Court of Appeals is evaluating the, I guess they're not because of the way the trial court decided it, but they're evaluating how they would have, you know, rather than applying an abuse of discretion standard.
That's correct. Because
of why the way the trial court came to its decision?
Well, I think one would have to ask whether the abuse of discretion standard, as that term is commonly used in evaluating, for instance, the trial court's ruling on a motion for a new trial, what sense does that standard have when we are talking about the process of objective logical inferences from a record. It is much more in the nature of a legal conclusion than it is in factual conclusions. On that point, though, it is crucial to observe that the deference that the state would have this court give to the trial court's decision regarding, quote, credibility is utterly unsupported in this case. It is indisputable that in the trial court's decision, the trial judge here did say the alternate juror's testimony is incredible. I find that he lacks credibility. The oddity of that is that in every single particular, the four jurors whom the alternate juror identified as having participated in the various acts of misconduct corroborated line by line and event by event and statement by statement precisely what the alternate juror had said occurred. So one has to wonder if such a tag of credibility judgment is worthy of any deference that it might be suggested under the abuse of discretion standard. Equally puzzling is the error that infests the trial court's summary of the evidence, because the trial court said, as did the state in the argument before you today, that there was no misconduct other than by the alternate juror. But as the briefs make clear, that is simply false. At least two other jurors participated specifically in discussions with the alternate juror that constituted misconduct, and they testified to having done so. And more fundamentally, if the Court of Appeals rule, every single time there was any misconduct, whether it be by the alternate juror alone or by other people, and the juror failed to report that event to the trial court, that's an act of misconduct, because every juror who fails to report such misconduct is violating the instruction. There's no excuse for that. The trial court's conclusions are not warranted to deference, even if this court were to apply the abuse of discretion standard. The record is clear that misconduct existed. The Court of Appeals' objective appraisal of how that misconduct would have affected a juror in the unique, specific circumstance of this case comports entirely with the method approved by the common law for centuries and establishes without doubt that prejudice occurs.
At least is that light indicates you're about out of time. You're going to get to the cross appeal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. There are four issues raised in the cross appeal of this case. The first issue could not be clearer. We have a grant of immunity to a witness in this case under the prevailing statute, 2945.44. That statute makes it an absolute prerequisite that before someone's entitled to immunity under that statute, she must have a valid Fifth Amendment claim. This court said in Landrum in 1990 what every court has ever said, including the United States Supreme Court, about the existence of a Fifth Amendment privilege. Two prongs are required. First, your testimony must be self-incriminating. That's what the Fifth Amendment says. Second, you must have a real and appreciable fear of prosecution. With respect to both prongs, both of which are required under the statute, Ms. Babb is not entitled to immunity. Her testimony, as you well know, was not self-incriminating, it was exculpatory. And second, she had no real appreciable fear of prosecution. How do we know that? Because the state's lawyer said it on the record to the trial judge. We have no intention of prosecuting her. Her thought that she might face cross-examination is not to stand on her involvement in the death of Alex Brown. It's not self-incrimination, and it's not an appreciable fear of prosecution. The immunity grant was wrongful. It was gravely prejudicial, as it set forth in detail in the brief. The Court of Appeals correctly concluded that there is an issue about the grant of immunity, but was utterly wrong in rejecting that claim. This court should rule clearly that the grant of immunity was wrong, so that the proceedings on the remand are not infected by that erroneous grant. Likewise, there are three severe evidentiary errors that occurred in the trial court. The testimony of the state's three coroner experts that axonal shearing was the cause of death in this case was all inadmissible for several reasons. Under this court's precedence and under the clear language of They have Ohio rules of evidence.
You need to sum up, Mr. Byer.
I'm sorry?
You need to sum up your red light.
The briefs made clear that the evidentiary testimony was jury-rigged after the fact, was unsupported by physical evidence that was verifiable and was intrinsically not reliable, and is unavoidable that the coroners changed their opinions, because their opinions at trial were contrary to earlier opinions, contrary to earlier documents, should not have been admitted. Likewise, it was fair to prohibit the introduction of Dr. Patrick's contradictory testimony. The judgment of the Court of Appeals reversing the conviction must be affirmed. This court should also uphold the four cross assignments of error, so that on remand, the trial that Mr. Reiner gets in this case, if there be a trial, is not infected by those great errors.
Thank you, Mr. Byer. I understand you saved a little more than 2.5 minutes of your time.
I'll try to be very brief. And I want to specifically respond to Justice Gross' statement or question about what the judge should do at the trial stage to determine it. I would refer to court case 233 of this court's decision, State versus Shepherd, where the court said, here the trial court determined that the appellant suffered no harm or prejudice as a result of the juror's brief conversation with a psychologist. The court may determine a juror's impartiality has remained unaffected based upon the juror's testimony. So even if this court has ruled, then you can't question the juror as to determine his partiality. I don't think it's conclusive, but I think the case cited by that is Smith versus Phillips, the United States Supreme Court case, that said that the juror's testimony in regards to his impartiality is not inherently suspect, and that the court can do that, and it's an abuse of discretion standard that the court then made that decision based on the evidence that appeared at that time. The other issue, and I know that this court will actually review that the transcripts here, but Mr. Byers statement said everything that the alternate jurors said was uncontroverted or corroborated by all the other jurors. That's just simply a falsehood. And just to a couple of examples, the court will look at when you look back on the record, is that one, he said, two jurors said that there was testimony by them that the alternate juror told that the Catholics had been paid a certain amount of money to represent him. He specifically denied making that statement. They go through one aspect of his credibility. The other thing is, the Court of Appeals talked about how the alternate juror made positive statements about the coroner's testimony. A review of his testimony during the course of that hearing is he never said anything positive about them. He also talked about that the captain, so Mr. Robert Captain, had written a book on Shane and Davis, and when he got that information during the course of the trial from an attorney at a local law office, he was not able to even give the name of the attorney that gave him that. I went down and asked every attorney he knew at that law firm, and it was just so incredulous, and it appeared that he was making up this stuff that he was testifying, and he truly was incredible. And the court specifically went and made the findings of fact as to his lack of credibility. I think the court can base its decision on the Court of Appeals not finding an abuse of discretion, and it's up to the court, the trial court, to make that finding, and the Court of Appeals should not supplant the trial court's finding of those factual issues. In regards to the immunity issue, it would be the state position, you don't have standing to contest that aspect of it. It's a prosecutorial tool for the situation where a witness who is represented by counsel who had previously in a juvenile matter concerning the same instances had taken the Fifth Amendment, I believe, 18 times, and that was not objected to by those same defense attorneys, now wants to maintain that Fifth Amendment at trial.
Had it been objected to, would you accept the fact that they had standing?
No.
So your argument on an objection is not pertinent. Your first argument simply is they don't have standing to raise this issue.
Period.
Okay. Now, if that's the case, then we're in a position where if there is, let's say, a gross manifestation of this alleged error, let's just for purposes of argument accept that there is, a defendant can never raise that?
I believe if they can show some type of due process violation that they could probably then raise it, but that would be raised different issues as regards to ones in Brady.
Well, but isn't that what they're raising, due process? They didn't get a fair trial. Couldn't get a fair trial because the person who was given immunity was, in fact, one of the people that the finger was being pointed at.
Right, but he had a right to question that person. I believe that the error was detected by the defense attorney for themselves by their arguments.
Okay, I don't want to get into the facts of this specific case. It's always seemed to me that you grant immunity only when the testimony is going to be incriminating. Now, if you say that they have no standing to raise that, I can understand that. I then go to the next step, where there's a gross violation of it. Somebody has to have the ability to raise it. And if you raise it and show that, in fact, there was no jeopardy, then why is that not a due process issue?
Well, how are they prejudiced by that aspect of it? They have a right to file a motion of immunity where the jury would never even hear that the person was trying to immunity. They wanted to beat up that person or attack his credibility based upon the grant of immunity. All this is a fear or apprehension or legitimate apprehension of the of prosecution. You're basically saying, well, wait a second, the person later on didn't incriminate himself the way that we thought he would. Well, the remedy is possibly perjury charges, which is set forth in the statute. The other remedy would be that they don't then argue that aspect of it to the jury. But the issue is that there is actually no prejudice to them in regards to that. And that we're asking you to make after the decision or a hindsight determination, when the court has to make that determination prior to hearing any of the testimony there. And I believe that the record establishes that the court has sufficient evidence to grant the immunity at the request of prosecutors at that time. The fact is that it does turn out that way later on is using hindsight to make a determination, and you can never put the cart before the horse.
That little part of the record that I was able to review before this came seems to me that the counsel for Miss Batt had told the judge in advance, or it was known in advance, that she was going to deny any culpability. So immediately the judge had to know, and the prosecution even said there would be no prosecution. Now, if those two points are so, doesn't that lead you to the conclusion that the trial court knew or had to know that there was going to be no incriminating testimony and therefore no grant of immunity?
We don't have to be there were also other injuries that occurred there in this particular case. I was prosecuting a incident involving one fatal injury, but there were other injuries to this child that occurred. There was also injuries to the twin that also occurred that she might subject herself to possible cross-examination on that. She may not have said that I didn't shape the cause of this child's death, but she would then be subject to a lot of cross-examination that could lead to incriminating.
Well, was your statement only with regard to the alleged homicide? I thought your statement, as I read it in there, said we have no intention of prosecuting her, period.
That's correct.
So that would be for anything.
I didn't, well, and they probably covered that aspect of it, but the only thing that she didn't say anything incriminating about was whether or not she inflicted the fatal injury. There were no questions they asked about her in regards to whether or not she inflicted the other injuries, or I don't recall it. So maybe she just hadn't denied that, but there was no representation that she was not going to be talking about that aspect of it. I was, her testimony was saying that she wasn't going to implicate herself about the fatal case.
Did the judge in this case inform the jury that
that's correct.
Isn't that where the judge is saying the judge comes from? The judge is saying, you don't have to look at this woman, even though that's the whole defense. I judge it, don't you?
Right. But that was the trial technique they wanted to use, that they wanted to bring up the fact that she had taken the Fifth Amendment on, I don't know how many occasions over and through the court. They could have filed a motion in limine, and the judge would then not have instructed it, and the person would have testified as, and the jury would not have known that she was granted immunity. That was a possibility. They could have done it. But their trial tactic was they wanted to beat up this witness and take the inference that, I don't know if it's permissible under Burton versus California, although I guess that's being contested now, that there should be a negative influence drawn on the fact that a person only testifies under the grand immunity. That could have been taken away from the jury, but they wanted to do that as a trial tactic. And because that tactic did not work, they can't come down to this court and say, well, we want to try the other tactic now. And that's the way I got to do that situation. And I believe I'm out of time. It would be a safe position that you reverse on the 9th Assignment of Error by the Court of Appeals and affirm on the counts that were appealed to or granted reviewed by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Byers, you've used your time as you say 30 seconds on your vote and your cross-appeal.
Stratton's question gets to the essence of the prejudice. The grant of immunity by the judge has nothing to do with defense strategy. When the judge, the impartial auditor in the courtroom, turns to the jury and says, as you said, Your Honor, effectively, I have determined that the interests of justice will be served. If Susan Babb is forever relieved of the chance of criminal responsibility for his crime, this is a judge telling the jurors that the interest of justice, that the interest of justice is served solely by having Matthew Reiner stand trial. That is a judicial endorsement of the innocence of Ms. Babb, a judicial condemnation of the defense and its experts in a gravely prejudicial act. Your question is very prescient. The judgment of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed to the extent of reverse conviction. The cross appeal should be upheld so that, as I said earlier, if there be a retrial in this case on the remand, it did not be infected by the grave prejudicial errors that are raised in the cross assignments. Thank you.
Thank you. Case submitted. We'll be advised for our opinion. Marshall, please adjourn the court.
All rise. Hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.
Thank you.